reducing the risk for others around you as well. Stay away from people.
Go ahead.
Just stay safe and stay well. Know that we can all do our part.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lena Nguyen, emergency room physician, public health professor at George Washington University, former Baltimore health commissioner. We'll link to her Washington Post piece as the latest as states reopen. Here's how you protect yourself from the coming surge. As we wrap up the show, I wanted to send good wishes out to a woman who's changed everything. A very happy, meaningful, landmark birthday to Naomi Klein. Happy birthday, Naomi. Democracy Now! Is working with as few people as possible on site. The majority of amazing team is working from home. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm. At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to News Director, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned, values-driven natural foods cooperative open daily from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. during the pandemic. Featuring farm direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and farmers market every Wednesday year round. Located at Southeast Tibbetts Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. Online at peoples.coop.
And now, your daily volunteer produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Mayor Ted Wheeler has proposed a new budget for the 2020 to 2021 fiscal year. Oregon churches have sued Kate Brown over social distancing restrictions And in national news, a second top White House aide has tested positive for coronavirus. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 8th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. 10 churches in Oregon have banded together to sue Governor Kate Brown. They claim her executive orders violate their First Amendment rights. In March, the governor issued an executive order requiring Oregonians to stay home unless they are essential workers, need medical treatment, or are exercising and getting groceries. The suit was brought on behalf of the churches by the Pacific Justice Institute. In a statement, attorney Ray Hack said, "Churches and churchgoers are not willing to let their constitutionally protected religious right be infringed upon indefinitely," end quote. The suit claims that under Oregon law, the governor can only shut down the state for 30 days before requiring legislative approval. Her stay-at-home order was issued on March 23rd. Hack said that the churches are not being reckless and don't wish to put their elderly and vulnerable parishioners at risk, and that they would follow social distancing guidelines. At her press conference yesterday, the governor said that the restrictions will slowly begin to lift starting on May 15th. They were heroes last week, but soon many of Oregon's hospital workers may be facing pay cuts, furloughs, or layoffs. A story in today's Oregonian noted that last week, Legacy Health notified nearly 6,000 employees that they will be required to take temporary pay cuts or 10 to 15 days off without pay. Legacy's action followed similar moves by the Oregon Health and Science University and others last month. At that time, Providence cut executive compensation by anywhere from 10 to 50%, and recently said it will leave vacant positions unfilled and reduce temporary workers while considering additional steps. The COVID-19 surge that health professionals predicted never happened in Oregon, but the same emergency orders that slowed the spread of the virus also contributed to a significant loss of revenue by hospitals and other healthcare providers due to its ban on elective procedures. That ban was lifted last Friday, but between the ban and people avoiding hospitals and doctors due to virus fears, some hospital departments have seen revenues plummet as much as 70%. And even though the ban was lifted, providers are seeing a slow rebound. Nervous patients are still postponing elective procedures, and an increased focus on safety and facility sterilization means that fewer procedures can be performed during one shift. Organized labor is demanding protection for its workers. The Oregon Nurses Association and other unions want any financial assistance to hospitals to be linked to worker protection. And on Thursday, the American Federation of Federal, State, County, and Municipal Employees held an event with Representative Earl Blumenauer demanding that the federal government include worker protection in any aid package to state and local governments. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler thinks the city can avoid harsh cuts in next year's budget. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has more.
The city of Portland is anticipating a $75 million reduction in the general revenue fund for the fiscal year 2020 to 2021, which begins on July 1st. But Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler thinks he's found a way to make up for the anticipated revenue shortfall without drastic cuts. The shortfall is based on an anticipated reduction in collections associated with tourism, business, and property taxes. But Wheeler believes that Portland can make up for the shortfall without the layoffs and major bureau cuts that other cities have seen. The gap will be closed by tapping the city's reserves, limiting new spending, and implementing wage freezes and temporary furloughs for city employees. Non-union employees have already had wages frozen and are required to take a 10-day furlough. The city is also negotiating with the leaders of labor unions in hopes of getting similar concessions. In a statement, Wheeler said, quote, "In order to avoid layoffs, I've asked our labor leaders to share in the sacrifice that others have already taken." The proposed budget promises to maintain the current level of funding for homeless services and funds the operation and maintenance costs of the city's 21 parks that are scheduled to open this year. It promises over $450,000 to groups that did not receive a federal stimulus check and may not be eligible for unemployment benefits. About half of that will go to support the state's effort to provide legal defense for immigrants and refugees, with much of the rest going to a fund to assist the workers who didn't qualify for unemployment. $5,000 would also be allocated to the Street Roots Vendor Assistance Fund. The plan also allocates about 80% of the money that the Portland Housing Bureau received from the federal coronavirus relief package to rent support for 1,300 households. The City Council is scheduled to hear public testimony from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. on Tuesday, May 12th, and the complete budget is available for review on the PortlandOregon.gov website. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
With some of the most beautiful parks in the country, many Oregonians are looking forward to weekend temperatures in the 80s and itching to get out of the house and enjoy the weather. Although the governor's stay home, stay safe order is still in effect, many parks and hiking trails are starting to reopen. On Tuesday, Governor Kate Brown announced the opening of some state parks and recreation areas, although the coastal beaches and Columbia Gorge remain closed. In Portland and many surrounding cities, parks, nature trails, and golf courses are open. Indoor recreation facilities, playgrounds, and sports fields remain closed. Many parks will have greeters on hand to remind visitors of social distancing guidelines, and the National Recreation and Parks Association reminds people to wash their hands before and after visiting the park and maintain at least 6 feet of distance from others. Since mid-March, Oregon Food Bank has distributed more than 1 million pounds of food across Oregon and Southwest Washington. For more on the story, here's Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service.
The coronavirus outbreak is devastating the economy and leading to surges in hungry people. Oregon Food Bank is stepping up to meet the challenge and believes we can emerge stronger from this crisis. The food distribution network says its partners around the state have seen 20 to 60% spikes in demand for hunger relief over the last few weeks. Oregon Food Bank CEO Susanna Morgan says it's the biggest crisis she's seen in her 24 years working in food banking. But she adds that meals still are flowing to 1,300 assistance sites distributing food across Oregon and Southwest Washington each week.
I have heard of exactly one in this eight-week period that ran out of food before they got to the end of the line. So I'm incredibly proud of our network and the tens of thousands of people who are making this happen.
Donations for Oregon Food Bank's hashtag Emerge Stronger Community Challenge is allowing the network to deploy more than $4.1 million to get their emergency response plan running, according to a report from the organization. Some communities have a harder time getting assistance. Oregon Food Bank is committing $300,000 to reaching immigrant communities because people who are undocumented don't qualify for SNAP or food stamps. Morgan notes that even folks who have gained legal status can't get assistance for 5 years. She says it's especially important to support immigrant Oregonians now because many are in frontline jobs, working in meat plants, healthcare, or as farm workers.
Our immigrant communities are keeping us fed and healthy during this pandemic, and so I feel like we collectively have a responsibility to wrap our arms around every one of our neighbors.
Morgan says this crisis could provide an opportunity to better support folks on the other side of the pandemic.
The Food Assistance Network is the last defense against hunger, not the first. The first defense should be a good offense, right? Living wage jobs, access to health care, affordable housing, good education.
Along with donations, Oregon Food Bank has secured $8 million from the state to supplement food supplies until July, when the organization anticipates federal aid will arrive. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
According to the latest figures from the U.S. Labor Department, unemployment in the U.S. is at the highest rate since the Great Depression of the 1930s. Over 20 million Americans lost their jobs in the month of April, bringing the national unemployment rate to 14.7%. As recently as February, the unemployment rate was at a 50-year low of 3.5%. The economic collapse brought on by the onset of the coronavirus pandemic wiped out nearly 10 years of continuous employment growth in only 2 months. Analysts pointed out that the unemployment rate is certainly an undercount, since filings so far in May are not included in the April number. In an interview on Fox News earlier today, President Trump predicted a quick rebound, saying, quote, "Those jobs will all be back, and they'll be back very soon." But many economists were not so sure, pointing out that employment in the hospitality, entertainment, and travel sectors would be very slow to return. They pointed to the social distancing and crowd guidelines that will remain in place in many states as a reason for the slow rebound. Others believe the pandemic will result in a fundamental change in the way we live and work, and that many jobs will never come back. Low-wage workers in restaurant and retail sectors have been hit particularly hard, as have African Americans and Latinx people. The April rate for unemployment among Latinx people was 18.9%, and among African Americans, it reached 16.7%. Like Portland, Seattle has moved to close some streets to through traffic during the COVID-19 pandemic in order to allow for social distancing for pedestrians and cyclists. Unlike Portland, Seattle has decided to make these closures permanent, according to Mayor Jenny Durkin. The Stay's Healthy Streets program was rolled out in stages in a number of area neighborhoods to improve social distancing and accessibility for those traveling without cars. Coronavirus has disrupted public transit in Seattle, as it has in many other major cities, and the closures are also an effort to make sure people can get around safely without it. In the 20 miles of streets now permanently closed to through traffic, residents, delivery drivers, and first responders will still be able to drive on the streets. Seattle politics has long grappled with its lack of major infrastructure for cyclists, which has been a challenge as the city has pushed for residents to move away from commuting by car. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned at 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. And at 7, it's The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight's weather, we can expect clear skies with an overnight low of about 62. Tomorrow and Sunday, we can look forward to sunny skies with temperatures both days reaching the mid-80s. On this day in 1980, the World Health Organization announced that smallpox had been eradicated. The quote of the day is from Dr. Anthony Fauci, who has been the director of the National Center for Allergies and Infectious Diseases since 1984. During a 2005 interview with newsman Bill Moyers, he said, quote, "A pandemic influenza would mean widespread infection essentially throughout every region of the world," end quote. The Trump administration has shelved a step-by-step outline on how to reopen restaurants and other public places during the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. The 17-page report was produced by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and was written by the nation's top disease investigators. The detailed report was supposed to be published today, but according to an unnamed CDC official, scientists were told that the report would, quote, never see the light of day. The guidelines were written to help business owners, educators, faith leaders, and state and local officials navigate the delicate process of reopening the economy. Historically, it has been the job of the CDC to provide public and local officials with science-based guidance and information during a health crisis. But during the coronavirus emergency, that role has been usurped by Trump and the coronavirus team led by Vice President Mike Pence. Trump's frequent daily briefings have been widely cited for misinformation and outright lies, often appearing more like a campaign rally than an emergency briefing. In an effort to secure his re-election, most observers agree that the administration's efforts are clearly prioritizing an economic rebound over the health of Americans. Yesterday, Trump tweeted that, quote, "People want our country to open up," end quote, and in a video promised that the economy would come back very, very strong. According to the AARP, it's important to keep asking nursing homes questions during the coronavirus pandemic. Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service has this story.
AARP Oregon wants families with loved ones in nursing homes to consider asking more questions when working with facilities. Residents of long-term care facilities are one group known to be at a higher risk from the new coronavirus. As of mid-April, more than half of COVID-19 deaths in Oregon originated in these facilities. Volunteer State President of AARP Oregon, Elaine Friesen-Strang, says that's why it's important to know where the virus is.
We're really advocating that the names of facilities with confirmed cases must be made public on a daily basis. We need that information to make wise decisions.
Friesen-Strang says families should know if a resident, staff member, or vendor at the facility has tested positive for COVID-19. She says facilities also need to keep families connected through virtual visits, since in-person meetings have been halted for now and many residents are feeling isolated. AARP Oregon also wants families to ask about facilities' virus prevention methods, if they have enough personal protective equipment for both staff and residents, and if they're at full staffing levels. Friesenstrang says that includes nurses and aides, and if they're short-staffed, inquire about plans to fill the gaps. She says AARP has been hearing from concerned families.
It can be very frustrating to advocate for your loved one when you're not allowed to go visit. And we know just by the sheer age of folks who generally live in nursing homes, by their underlying medical conditions, that they are more at risk.
She adds that if people are concerned about the safety of a loved one, they should reach out to Oregon's long-term care ombudsman. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Earlier today, the White House confirmed that a close aide to Vice President Mike Pence has tested positive for the coronavirus. It's the second time this week that a White House aide was found to have the virus. The announcement was made by the president, who said, quote, a press person named Katie had tested positive. At the time, it wasn't clear that Trump was referring to Katie Miller, Pence's press secretary. She is married to Trump White House advisor Stephen Miller. Pence had been scheduled to depart for Des Moines, Iowa this morning, but the flight was delayed to remove several aides who were scheduled to travel with him. Those aides were tested because contact tracing had confirmed that they had contact with Ms. Miller. She was not on the plane, and an official said that those aides were asked to get tested and go home out of an abundance of caution. On Thursday, the U.S. military confirmed that a personal valet to the president had tested positive. To date, nearly 80,000 Americans have died of COVID-19, yet both the president and vice president routinely refused to wear masks. Last week, the vice president prompted outrage when he visited the Mayo Clinic without a mask on, and earlier this week, the president was seen without a mask during a visit to an Arizona factory that manufactures N95 masks. Earlier today, he didn't wear a mask during a wreath-laying ceremony commemorating the end of World War II, in an event that was attended by 80 and 90-year-old veterans of the conflict. At a time when it is still difficult for most Americans to get a single coronavirus test, the president, vice president, and a number of senior White House staffers are tested daily. Tribes across the country are finally getting funding that was provided in the CARES Act. With that story and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribes across the country are starting to receive payments from the $8 billion set aside for tribes in the CARES Act. The funds were delayed from going out in late April. The Treasury and Interior Departments on Tuesday announced plans to begin disbursement of relief aid to tribes, which includes holding back payments to Alaska Native corporations due to pending litigation. The Ho-Chunk Nation was notified Wednesday it received multi-million-dollar funding. The Wisconsin tribe applied for the funds in March to respond to the public health emergency. The Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians received more than $37 million. The Navajo Nation confirmed Wednesday it received $600 million in funding. The funds are to be used for medical needs and public health measures such as food delivery and distant learning. 60% of the $8 billion is being dispersed to tribes. Meanwhile, the state of New Mexico recently launched a task force to address COVID-19 on the Navajo Nation. Members include health professionals, policy experts, and former military law enforcement personnel. Kevin Washburn, law school dean and former U.S. Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs, is a member of the task force.
There's just so many different facets of the problem. There's what is the medical response? How do you know, what's the testing? What's the contact tracing? How do you manage the cases? And then there are the facilities issues. What, you know, do we have bed space? Do we have quarantine space? How do people get from here to there? And, you know, transportation between sites and that sort of thing. Then there's all the humanitarian issues. You know, water distribution at Navajo is a challenge. And, you know, do people have PPE? You know, public education is an issue because, you know, we're all struggling to understand this. There's still a digital divide in the Navajo Nation. And so those are some of the different issues that are being addressed by the teams and the subgroups of the team.
The teams working with the Navajo Nation, the governor's office, and the state's departments of health and Indian affairs to develop strategies to limit the spread of COVID-19 and ensure the tribal response is a priority. Navajo leaders welcomed the effort. As of Wednesday, the number of positive COVID-19 cases for the Navajo Nation reached 2,654 and 85 deaths. Many Native artists have lost income due to COVID-19, but they have not stopped creating. China Lockett talks with a Pine Ridge, South Dakota-based Lakota artist.
Native American tribes across the country used to warp rawhide into containers, then decorate the outside with color pigments from nature. The traditional work is called parfletch art. Sean Espinoza has been working with the medium for years. In the warmer season, Espinoza sometimes prepares and processes the animal hides himself. The rest of the time, he'll purchase processed hides. Then he cuts out the shapes he needs and binds them together. He finishes boxes and pouches with colorful painted geometric shapes.
I try to maintain the old methods, but I throw in modern techniques as well, because I do believe, you know, if the Lakotas had acrylic paint back in the day, which is what I used, that they would have utilized it.
He says parfletch bags and boxes were used to transfer food, clothing, and ceremonial items, and they're built to last.
The ones they show in the museums, you know, they look all battered and beaten and old. You know, it's because they were out in the weather and in battles. You know, they got trampled on by soldiers' horses.
Businesses purchase his work to sell to tourists in the summer months. Right now, many of those buyers are closed, and his income depends on the sales he can make to individuals.
I wish sales were better right now, but yeah, they're really bleak right now, but it's enough to get by, you know, and that's pretty much the story of my career is, you know, providing for my family, even in the most dire situations.
Many other artists are in the same position right now, hoping to make just enough to get by. I'm Trina Lockett in Rapid City.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The National Education Association says that teachers should be more involved in the process of reopening the country, and advocates are concerned about Betsy DeVos's new guidelines on Title IX. With more on the story, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Whether it is Donald Trump's Blue Ribbon Committee on how we're going to open up the economy, or a governor's task force on how we're going to open up businesses and all the rest, not one of them thought to put a teacher on one of those committees.
It's the last day of National Teacher Appreciation Week, and parents are reportedly highly supportive of how educators are handling the pandemic. President of the National Education Association, Lily Eskelsen-Garcia, says getting kids back in school is a crucial step in opening up the economy, but no one's asking the teachers for advice.
I had 39 kids in my classroom, in my sixth grade classroom once. I would tell those CEOs of corporations, here's why you can't put 39 kids back in that classroom and socially distance them.
Eskelsen-Garcia leads the nation's largest union. She criticized Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos's reversal of Obama-era Title IX guidelines for handling charges of sexual harassment and assault, saying DeVos, quote, woefully ignored, unquote, input from educators as well as students. DeVos says the changes bolster protections for accused students. They also reduce schools' legal obligation to investigate charges unless the misconduct is, quote, so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive, unquote, that it harms a student's access to education. For college students, each person's representative or lawyer is now required to live cross-examine the other student. That can make it harder to get to the truth, says Wagatwe Wanjuki, co-founder of Survivors Eradicating Rape Culture.
This harms both sides, both the complainant and the respondent, because, like, what if there's a power differential where somebody's able to afford a really wealthy lawyer and another student just has, like, a professor that they really like advocating for them?
Wanjuki says nobody wants the scales tipped in their favor.
It's not survivors versus accused, right? It's not like the complainant versus the respondent. It's not a men versus women. It is, you know, fairness and civil rights or not.
Former Vice President Joe Biden says he'd reverse DeVos's changes if elected. He's facing a sexual assault allegation from former Senate aide Tara Reid. 25 women have accused President Donald Trump of sexual misconduct. Politicians and famous people tend to get the most attention within the Me Too movement. Wanjuki says that's not good enough.
Where I want to focus now is working more on the grassroots, where we have the most vulnerable being listened to and being centered. And we set an agenda.
In other news, Andrew McCabe, former deputy director of the FBI, called the Department of Justice's decision to drop a criminal case against Michael Flynn, quote, pure politics designed to please the president, unquote. Flynn, Trump's first national security advisor, pleaded guilty to lying about his communications with Russia, but later withdrew his plea. McCabe helped oversee the Russia probe. He was fired 2 years ago and maintains his dismissal was politically motivated. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
a Missouri botanical garden, is helping local residents to go solar. With more on that story, here's Dr. Anthony Liesowitz with today's edition of Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Liesowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The Missouri Botanical Garden has long been a trusted resource for information about plants and gardening. And now, local residents can turn to the garden to learn more about going solar.
One of the things that we hear the most from people is that, you know, I'm really interested in going solar at my home, but it's complicated, and there's so many things for me to consider, and I'm busy, and I'll get to it one of these days.
That's Glenda Abney of the Botanical Garden Sustainability Division. Last year, the garden partnered with Washington University in St. Louis and the Midwest Renewable Energy Association on a program called Grow Solar St. Louis. The program offers information sessions designed to make it easy for local residents who are interested in installing solar at their homes.
At the end of the program, our solar providers are at the back of the room. You can go ahead and talk to them right then. Give them your address. They pull it up. They have a special software program, and they can tell you right then, with an initial review, if your home is viable.
In the first year, more than 70 participants installed solar panels, which exceeded expectations. So Abney says they plan to offer the program again. She says by encouraging clean energy, the garden is helping clean up the planet for plants and people. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 8th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The remote producer for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Lily Volke, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.